The UK has apparently just declared a climate emergency. So maybe we could just start by saying, what does that mean? Well, we've just declared a climate emergency. Do you know what that means?
What it means is that we've got something with which to hold the government to account now in everything it does. So, like the third runway at Heathrow. How does that fit with declaring a climate emergency?
Yeah, or in Bristol, expanding.
Or in Bristol, expanding Bristol Airport. M4 extension through the Gwent levels. I mean, all over the country, we've got new fossil fuel-based infrastructure being built. We've got fracking going on. We've got attempts to extract every last drop of fossil fuels out of the ground and burn them. So if we've declared a climate emergency, and I'm delighted that we have, and congratulations, by the way, to all of you who have helped to make that happen, because it wouldn't have happened
Amazing.
Without Extinction Rebellion and the youth climate strikes. The incredible, inspiring movements of people who have made this happen. But if we have indeed declared a climate emergency, then it should change everything. And our task now is to use this great opportunity, which has just been created, to push for those dramatic and radical changes that a true state of emergency demands. And that means leaving fossil fuels in the ground. Very rapidly, switch to leaving almost all fossil fuels in the ground and bring on stream the technologies required to replace them. That means an end, more or less, to livestock keeping, because one of the biggest impacts of all is animal agriculture. That means, obviously, an end to fossil fuel-based infrastructure, because there's absolutely no point in having it if you can't burn the fossil fuels. But above all, and the biggest thing of all, is it means an end to economic growth. Because you cannot prevent climate breakdown, let alone wider environmental breakdown, while we continue to grow and grow and grow within a finite Earth system. Inevitably, we will burst through environmental boundaries. In fact, we've already broken through some of the critical planetary boundaries. And they want to keep growing. And in the past 40 years, our material resource consumption has tripled. This is a catastrophic level of impact on the planet's systems, on our life support systems. And they want to do this again and again and again. The World Bank and the OECD and people, they say, we're not asking for a lot, just 3% growth a year. That's our target. Well, as Lord Keynes pointed out, compound interest is what kills everything. And the same applies to compound growth. 3% a year means doubling in 24 years. So everything you see, this entire shit show, which is destroying the Earth's systems, is going to double and then double again. Oh, well, they say, don't worry about that, because we can decouple. We can decouple economic growth from material resource consumption. Very interesting analysis published just 2 weeks ago by Jason Hickel and Georgios Kallis in New Political Economy, showing that not only has absolute decoupling of material resource consumption never happened, that even the relative decoupling, which took place in the 20th century, where, in other words, material resource consumption would continue to grow but not as fast as economic growth was going, has been reversed in the 21st. There was meant to be this great switch as we move from a goods economy to a service economy. There was meant to be this dematerialization happening. Exactly the opposite has taken place. There's been this recoupling where material resource consumption is now matching or exceeding the rate of economic growth. And when you look at the possibility of absolute decoupling, which is the only way in which you could possibly have economic growth living alongside the prevention of environmental breakdown, you find that it is not just practically not happening, it is theoretically impossible. So if this government is serious, and if Parliament is serious about declaring a climate emergency and making that into a meaningful concept, then it is the entire system that has to change. To begin with.
Yeah. we're gonna come back to some of those things that you just mentioned then throughout the course of the evening. So we've got about just under an hour where I'm going to be having a conversation with George, talking through some of the questions around the theme of joining the dots. So we're going to be talking about the climate emergency, consumerism, mental health, but also some of the really exciting things that have been happening lately that have led us to this point this evening. And so we're going to focus on the themes, but we're also going to weave in and out of some other ones. So we're going to just start off looking at the fact that just 2 weeks ago, the BBC aired Climate Change, The Facts with David Attenborough. And it really felt like for the first time, the BBC didn't beat around the bush when it came to climate breakdown. So why do we have to wait, do you think, until Sir Dave says it before we pay attention?
Well, in truth, he wasn't saying it either. I mean, until very recently. This is the latest late flowering there's ever been. And his transformation into a radical environmentalist in his 93rd year is something we should welcome and celebrate. Because for me, it's been intensely frustrating. I mean, I started work. My only proper full-time job, was here at the Natural History Unit in Bristol.
Yeah.
And I came here to make investigative environmental programmes. They didn't exist at the time, and I basically beat down the door saying, look, you've got to be doing this. I know how to do this. I can do it for you. And I was eventually let in with the words, you're so fucking persistent, you've got the job.
Yes.
That is a verbatim quote from the head of the unit. Because it was the only thing I wanted to do. I was completely single-minded about this. I couldn't believe that it wasn't doing this stuff.
Yeah, to give that some context, that was like back in 1985.
85, yes. Yeah. So this was, you know, when you could still film the dinosaurs. and we made some fantastic programs. You know, we cracked some really big stories, and I thought, well, this is me. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, because it's great. We've got the resources of the BBC, and it was, you know, it's really, you know, what the BBC can do. It's completely different to what other media can do because it's so big, it's got such public reach, and it's got so much money that I thought this is just perfect. And then,
especially then when there was only like three channels.
Yeah, well, exactly. You had a captive
and no
audience.
Social media,
that's right. What more could you want? So, but then Mrs. Thatcher launched her coup against the BBC. It had made these programmes which had really embarrassed her. One called Secret Society about government spending, which wasn't approved by Parliament. Another one called Maggie's Militant Tendency about the people in her cabinet who had formerly been in fascist organisations. And for some reason, this didn't go down very well.
It did sound like a porn film, anyway.
And so, you know, with her great commitment, her oft long touted commitment to freedom, she shut the whole thing down. Mm. She sacked the Director General, Alistair Milne. She put an accountant in his place who was kind of all right but didn't know what he was doing. And then he went and this horrible John Burt came in instead. And the whole thing just became completely hostile to any interesting programme making. Mm. In fact, the day that Alistair Milne was sacked, my boss came in and said, that's it, we've had it from the top, no more investigative programmes. So this was the point at which I decided to leave the BBC.
Yeah.
But I did so with a heavy heart because, you know, nothing else was going to replicate that platform. And but, you know, I realised it was then dead from the neck up, and it's remained that way. But possibly, you know, there's some glimmering of life beginning to return. It's very interesting. If you look at the difference between Blue Planet Live, which was the series they did a few weeks ago, cashing in on the success of Blue Planet 2,
yeah.
And climate change the facts. They could belong to different eras. It's almost as if some major change happened between those two programmes. Blue Planet Live was pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. It was all about, oh, terrible things are happening to the oceans. We can't tell you exactly what they are, except it's bad.
Yeah. So let's look at a blue whale. Let's see if we can see one of those.
Yeah, and it's like, so what about the commercial fishing industry? We got a minute on the commercial fishing industry. That was it, industrial fishing. You know, industrial fishing is by far and away the biggest threat to the oceans. Mm. We had quite a lot about climate issues, but it was all sort of like, this thing, this mysterious thing called climate change is happening. They didn't explain why it was happening, who was driving it, what the force of it. We ought to do something about it. Well, what? What are we going to do? They didn't tell us. Oh, except do some coral seeding. We got some scientists coming to the rescue. And all these little micro techno fixes with no systemic challenge at all.
Yeah, just beating around the bush.
That's right. And that had characterised all BBC attempts at environmental programme making up till that point pretty well, with one or two very rare exceptions. Attenborough's previous climate film in 2006 called The Truth About Climate Change was a total disaster. And it set back the cause of climate action by years, because not only did it completely fail to explain what the issue was and where it was coming from. In fact, the only mention of fossil fuel companies in the whole programme was as part of the solution, Statoil burying carbon dioxide in its reservoirs with this carbon capture and storage thing. Otherwise, they weren't mentioned at all. The only clear force which was blamed was the Chinese, the yellow peril. You know, it was shocking. Disgraceful. No mention of the fact that the reason Chinese emissions were rising was they were manufacturing our goods. And so what that did immediately was to create this whole new front in climate change denial. And I was, from that moment, bombarded with messages saying, it's not us, it's the Chinese, we don't have to worry about it. What's the point in Britain acting? We're only 2%. Look at the Chinese doing all this, of those wretched Chinese. Mm. And so it was completely counterproductive, and it was typical of the cowardice of the BBC. But something has changed, and it's like a switch.
You called him on it, didn't you?
I did. I mean, I wrote this article saying that David Attenborough had basically betrayed the living world that he loved. And it was, you know, again and again, just flinching, refusing to name the powers. And, you know, as Walter Wink, the great theologian, pointed out, that is the first step. You cannot confront the powers until you have named them. You name them, you unmask them, you confront them. Those are the three steps of action. And if you can't even bloody name them, you can't start that process of activism. And it was like, we're not going to talk about this. And up until this point, or until about a few months ago, the only forces that Attenborough would talk about were things like population growth. Basically, people in other nations much poorer than ourselves having too many children. Mm. Never mind our consumption growth, which is going far higher and far faster and shows no sign of peaking at all, unlike population growth. And he said some deeply racist and unpleasant things about that. You know, basically saying we shouldn't have given aid to the Ethiopians during the famine because it only encouraged them.
Wow.
You know, quite extraordinary stuff. Yeah. But suddenly, in the past few months, there's been this flip, this turnaround. I'd love to take credit for it, but
I don't think I could. Do you think that that it could have the same effect for the Earth that Blue Planet 2 had for the oceans? Mm.
Well, Blue Planet 2 was a complete dog's breakfast. So we'd had this. It was the last of the programmes in the Blue Planet 2 series. I mean, the one we're talking about is the environmental one. So the first five programmes, which were all about the wonders of the ocean, were really good. You know, they were really spectacular. I mean, they were a bit scientifically dodgy, but it was beautiful filmmaking. It was great storytelling. There were very clear, discrete stories telling you about these amazing life forms and their behaviour, and it filled you with wonder and astonishment. Mm. All the time in the back of my mind is that, yeah, this whole lot is being treated by us as seafood. But, you know, we sort of, look, here's this amazing behaviour of this extraordinary wrasse, and look at the incredible things we do. And basically, yeah, that's going to end up on someone's plate. Mm. Yeah, this is seafood. That's our main engagement with it. So I was thinking, well, in the last programme, they're going to tell us all about that, aren't they? And it was a total mess from start to finish because they were so afraid of naming the powers. Yeah. So the only mention of commercial fishing, industrial fishing, the big threat, was this Norwegian herring fishery. And look, aren't they lovely because they're releasing the orcas and they've got this new way of doing it. Now, the Norwegian herring fishery is one of the 1% of fisheries around the planet which is in recovery. They didn't tell us that. They didn't tell us that all the other fisheries are trashing the entire marine ecosystem. And instead, there was a little bit of climate stuff, and it was just sort of pulled back always from the brink. So we can't actually tell you why it's happening or even particularly what it's doing. And then there was plastic stuff, and the plastic stuff was handled so badly. Mm. It was absolutely chaotic. It was terrible storytelling, terrible filmmaking.
It was like vaguely linking, like, you know, this calf may have died because of the milk, may have been contaminated with toxins from plastic pollution.
It was all over the shop. And it also, it was... actually seriously misled us, because most of the plastic coming into the ocean is coming from a few countries, going down a few rivers, which haven't got good waste disposal systems. Mm. But the impression it gave was that all the plastic that we're using is ending up in the ocean.
Well, to be fair, a lot of our plastic does end up in those countries.
It gets sold to them, but that wasn't explained either.
No.
So, you know, none of it was properly explained. Moreover, it didn't point out that a huge amount of marine plastic, and by far the most dangerous portion for marine life, is discarded fishing gear. Mm. So 46% of the Great Pacific garbage patch is nets, is ghost fishing nets. A large proportion of the rest of the patch is other fishing gear. Plastic buoys, all net floats, all the sort of bits and pieces of paraphernalia of fishing. And again, it's just like, we can't go there because that would actually be taking on some interest. It didn't mention the plastics industry and its expansion plans, its way of selling plastic. There's none of that stuff. Mm. And so you've got this really crazy stuff happening. So there was a prominent environmentalist who tweeted this picture of her plastic Tupperware, which she had taken to Tesco, and it was success, and it was this great sort of
triumph.
Look, I got them to put my king prawns in my plastic Tupperware instead of in a plastic bag. And she linked it to a campaign to save the oceans. King prawns is about the most disastrous thing you could possibly buy. There is this whole exercise in misdirection.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that kind of perfectionism thing later on, though, because I think
perfectionism.
That's like me tweeting a picture of me using a reusable cup on an aeroplane. We could have make a similar comparison there. But I think we'll definitely come back to that. In terms of so with climate change, the fact and our obsession, or perhaps like having to hear it from a celebrity before we pay attention. Do you think that that is indicative of our society, and that we need, you know, Emma Thompson to fly over on a plane from LA to Extinction Rebellion in London for the rest of society to come on board?
Well, there is a real issue here. I'm not sure I would classify either of them. I know this sounds weird, but I'm not sure I would say either of them are strictly celebrities, because... Yeah. I think a necessary but not sufficient condition being a celebrity is that you have appeared in an advertisement. That, for me, puts people on the wrong side of the line and they become a celebrity. Whereas, you know, a famous person, Attenborough or Emma Thompson or so, I don't think they've appeared in advertisements. I don't know. Maybe they have. But you know, famous people have always been with us. The peculiarity of our time, it's celebrity culture, which is absolutely hand in glove with the advertising and marketing industry. And that is, you know, this lethal combination of the way in which the media is now obsessed with spectacle as opposed to substance, and the commercial imperative to sell us more and more and more stuff in order to expand profits and capital share, driving economic growth.
Yeah.
Now, you know... there's always been an obsession with famous people, you know, whether it's kings and queens or conquering heroes or whoever it might be, going back thousands of years. But it's reached preposterous proportions now, and it's become a highly pernicious phenomenon with the intrinsic linkage of celebrity to advertising and the need to push stuff. And basically, celebrity is the mask the machine wears. So, you know, if you are a company whose headquarters is a filing cabinet in Panama City, which occupies some nondescript office block in Bangkok and is selling some gizmo in the UK, you have no means of connecting emotionally with the people you're trying to sell to. And because the people you're trying to sell to are those with disposable income, and because those with disposable income, by definition, have already met their own needs, their fundamental needs, and probably their major wishes as well, the only way you're going to get them to part with your money is to manufacture desires which they weren't previously aware of. And you can't do that if you can't connect with them, if you can't make that emotional connection with someone. So you need a mask. You need to pull a mask over the metal infrastructure, and that is the face of the celebrity that you're going to use in your marketing campaign. And the celebrity becomes your virtual neighbour. They become someone you think you know because you see them so often. You think they're your friend. They are not your friend. They are your enemy. They're the enemy of the whole Earth system. And what we've got to realise is that, you know, we've been treating celebrity culture as this harmless phenomenon for years, as if it's just something which happens separately to all the other systems. It is absolutely central to the system. They are the shock troops of capitalism, celebrities. So, you know, I'd say that any young people, stop following celebrities. They are destroying the planet.
But even if you're following environmentalists, even if you're following people that you respect and people that aren't famous just for being famous, you're still subject to a tirade of advertising. And I myself have fallen prey to it. I'm not a victim. I am, you know, occasionally a rampant consumer from time to time. Because you're in this feeling of connecting with your community and you're talking about positive things, and then an advert slips under the radar. Yeah. We were having an interesting conversation in the green room about The Guardian and its advertising. Because it is inherent, isn't it, in the social media that we're using for social change. There's still a lot of advertising in that.
I want to see it end. The Guardian's been experimenting with membership and doing very well with that, and I would love to see that replace advertising altogether, because advertising is a pox on the planet. It is absolutely essential to economic growth, to the expansion of capitalism into all spheres of life. It populates not only every corner of the planet, but also every corner of our minds. And it makes it very hard to think independently. I mean, thinking independently is kind of exaggerated anyway. You know, we are super social creatures. We're always absorbing social cues without realizing that we're doing it. Our minds are fantastically attuned to other people. In fact, you can't form a mind without other people. If you're put in solitary confinement, you literally lose your mind, which is why it's such an effective form of torture. So, you know, we are super socialised. With the possible exception of the naked mole rat, we are the most social of all mammals. And so the ideas we form, you know, very often we think we've had an original thought, but of course, and we might have had an original sub-thought or extension of a thought, but the infrastructure has been laid down by society. In fact, the very idea that you can form your own mind is a modern concept. 500 years ago, it would have been completely alien to people, the idea that you could form your own mind, the idea that you could have an individual thought process. That was not even part of the thought process. So that independence of mind is a recent aspiration, and it only goes so far. But, of course, you know, while it's absolutely right that we reflect and engage with society, we should also, to the greatest extent possible, think for ourselves, hard as that might be. But what advertising tries to do is to truncate that process, and it finds ever cleverer ways, using the latest neuroscience, the latest psychology, to basically stop us from exercising independent decision-making and to channel our minds towards its desires. And in doing so, they not only make us buy a particular product or encourage us rather to buy a particular product, but they also change our entire worldview. They change the way our minds work, because of course, you know, what fires together wires together, and if you're constantly being distracted and pulled by advertising, and the framing that advertising uses, which is all important, you know, as any neuro-linguistic scientist will show, cognitive linguist will show, you know, the framing, the way we talk about things is almost as important as the things we talk about. And advertising is constantly framing everything in commercial terms. Buy, buy, buy. Everything must go. Isn't that a telling phrase? And what it does is to change the way we think. It's pernicious.
So, I mean, avoiding it where possible. I think we've got Adblock Bristol as a partner in the room this evening, so we can talk about that in the second half as well. Maybe we can hear from the audience on that. I think, so are you seeing a shift? So just sort of on the media and BBC side, are you starting to see a shift in how the media are reporting climate breakdown?
Well, what I've seen is that thanks to the amazing work of the Youth Climate Strikers and Extinction Rebellion, we're seeing a lot more coverage of the issue, often by journalists who haven't a flying clue what they're talking about. And it is incredible, the levels of ignorance. I mean, you know, I have several times spoken to a researcher in a current affairs programme. And it's as if, you know, on the cultural side, it's as if you were to say, mention Hamlet, and they'd say, what's Hamlet? It's a play written by Shakespeare. Who's Shakespeare? Mm. You know, if they had that level, a lack of knowledge in culture or in politics, they couldn't sustain their job. But it seems perfectly acceptable to say to me, what's CO2?
Wow.
Or... sorry, you say that you got this percentage from that number. How did you do that? I'm not kidding. Or on another occasion, I said, I'm sorry, you're wrong by two orders of magnitude. You say it's twice as bad, they say. I mean, literally, this is how bad it is. Absolutely shocking. And you know, the BBC and other outlets are quite rightly exercised by the lack of diversity amongst their executives and their presenters. You know, not enough people of colour, not enough women, not enough people from working class backgrounds. What about the science graduates? Where are they? Mm-hmm. You know, they don't talk about that as part of their missing diversity, because boy, is it missing.
Yeah.
You know, it's humanities graduates almost throughout. Mm-hmm. And the level of ignorance is shocking, really extraordinary. I had someone rang me up the other day, and they started with this killer question. They thought, we're going to get in with this, you know, just to sort of test him out. This was just a researcher lining up a possible interview, which, of course, as usual, got cancelled. And so her killer question with which she began was, Mr. Monbiot, you say the climate is changing, but the ozone hole is closing up. It's just amazing. You know, we're not going to get very much out of them, and even less so, obviously, from the billionaire press. Mm. Because the billionaire press wants a world that billionaires will continue to dominate, and those billionaires have certainly a major interest in economic growth, a major interest in capitalism, and a major interest in fossil fuel companies.
There was some foul reporting of Extinction Rebellion in the Telegraph.
But I mean,
you've been, obviously, you've been a journalist with The Guardian for decades, and you've been on some fantastic programmes recently which have gone viral on the internet, and people have been sharing and watching them. But I think while we're on the subject of the media, your clip from Frankie Boyle, your interview you did with Frankie Boyle went viral.
Yeah.
It was good, but I have a little bit of a bone to pick. With it. I think should we just get this out of the way? Roll VT, boys.
What would you say people should do, George, if they do one thing?
I mean, what we have to do is the big structural political economic stuff. You know, what we're being told to do is change your cotton buds and all these sort of pathetic micro consumerist bollocks, which just isn't going to get us anywhere.
They They won't be inviting me back in a hurry.
Have you heard of the Switch the Stick campaign?
No.
No. Okay. I got some friends in the room.
All right.
So my organisation, City to See, were behind the Switch the Stick campaign, where we got all of the supermarkets in the UK to stop making cotton buds out of plastic.
Oh, God.
Which has stopped over 400 tons of non-recyclable single-use plastic at source every year, and plastic on I'm just going to milk this plastic on UK beaches from our toilets has actually dropped a quarter since the campaign. And credit to the other NGOs as well that have been banging the drum on that. So, I mean, I think, like, I'm going to challenge that. I think that plastic has been, for many people, a gateway to environmental issues and has shown people that actually we can affect change. And I think for so long people had been feeling quite powerless and around climate change, perhaps it feeling less tangible, but with plastic it's something we're feeling every day. Yeah. And we do need to challenge, like you say, the predicted growth of the plastics industry, which is set to triple by 2050 in terms of its share of global oil use.
Yeah.
I would say cotton buds is a good place to start.
All right. Okay. So what I'd say to this is, of course, we should do that stuff as well. But what I was complaining about there, and I should point out that I'd just recently watched Blue Planet Live, so I was steaming about this, and this was my chance on the BBC to have a swipe at it all, is that this stuff becomes a substitute for the structural change which is required. And boy, do I know enough people who say, well, I've changed my cotton buds, I use recyclable toilet paper, I recycle my bottles. And you say, but what about that holiday you're about to take to Thailand? Well, I'm green. It's all right. So this is how it is. That people... my friend George Marshall pointed me to this extraordinary thing where it was in this local newspaper where this couple had collected so many recycling vouchers from Tesco. Tesco had this scheme that they used it... Tesco allowed them to trade it for air miles so they could fly to the Caribbean for a holiday. and the point I'm trying to make is, I try to do all this stuff as well. I'm trying to be a more ethical consumer. But actually, as consumers, we are largely powerless. There are one or two things we can do which do make a very big difference. Stop flying, number one. Switch to a plant-based diet, number two. Leave your car behind, number three. These things are pretty major. They do make a big difference. But actually, the really big difference is the structural, political, economic stuff. This is where societies change. This is where our impacts change. This is where we switch from being a consumerist society to a non-consumerist society, which is the switch that we make. And my concern is that green consumerism is just a way of extending consumerism. The marketers and the advertisers are all over this like a rash, because they can say, okay, you bought some really bad stuff, now you can buy some really good stuff on top of it. And it's just, we're just buying more stuff. And it doesn't matter ultimately. I mean, it does matter, but it's only a few years of difference in your progress towards the cliff edge as to whether it's plastic you're using or whether it's more paper, more cotton, whatever it might be. Because ultimately, it's the overall volume of material resource use which is pushing us towards that cliff edge. So, by all means, substitute it, but don't allow yourself to believe that that's going to solve the problem. That's going to slightly mitigate the problem. We have to solve the problem, and that means structural change. Ultimately, it means the end of capitalism.
A I think we'll come back to the element of the perfectionism and you know, making those small changes versus still engaging in things that are more damaging. But I think moving on to that, when the clip continued, you talked about us overthrowing capitalism, and you said that the two main issues that we need to look at is ramping down all fossil fuel production and engaging in massive rewilding and ecological restoration. So we'll just break those two things down and look at what the biggest factors are that are preventing us from ramping down all fossil fuel production. Because I don't think it's realistic from the consumers at the moment for us to just, you know, for people to stop flying or to do the really big things that may not be a really big thing. But
is it? I think it is realistic. I mean, I honestly think it is realistic. I mean, maybe not to stop flying totally, but massively to cut down. That is totally realistic.
But wouldn't it be more realistic for there to be a fairer tax on flying so that it's not penalising, say, like, you know, a traveller that just wants to go off on their trip of a lifetime compared to people with a second home that are jetting off every other weekend?
No, I mean, we totally need that systemic change. That's what I'm talking about. But, you know, pending that systemic change, you know, we have to just stop doing our bit to wreck the planet. And that means you start with the big stuff first. The big stuff is the flying, the big stuff is diet, the big stuff is surface travel. These are the three big changes we can make as consumers. The rest, by comparison, you know, I'm not saying it's insignificant, but it's very small by comparison to those big changes. And those big changes we make as consumers are very small by comparison to the structural changes we need to make as citizens. It is as citizens we are most powerful. For God's sake, this is what Extinction Rebellion and the youth climate strikes have just shown us. This is why we've had the government declaring a climate emergency. Because we acted as citizens, not just as consumers.
Absolutely. So what are the biggest factors then to seriously ramp down fossil fuel production? What are the key factors?
So in that case, those two things I mentioned were specifically on preventing climate breakdown. I mean, there's all sorts of other things we need to do to prevent the wider ecological breakdown, Earth systems breakdown, caused by material resource consumption in general. But to prevent climate breakdown, leaving fossil fuels in the ground is absolutely the crucial thing. Now, you know, all the technologies we need to replace them as fuel are already there.
Yeah.
You know, there's one or two material issues, but, you know, in terms of what do we replace plastics with, that's a different issue. But in terms of fossil fuel, you know, we could do this tomorrow technologically. It's the political will that is missing.
Yeah.
And that means we need to continue these extremely effective mass mobilizations in order to generate the political will, because civil disobedience is the only thing that does. It's absolutely essential to political change. You cannot have major political change without it. Of course, you need all the party politics and stuff running alongside that. You need the representative democracy and stuff, but the catalyst that makes it happen is civil disobedience. Yeah. That is absolutely crucial. So we need to continue and expand that. Now, the science is telling us very clearly, the IPCC, as well as other scientists independently of it, that even if we were to cut almost all our greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, just like that, with a cliff edge like that, we would almost certainly still exceed 1.5 degrees of global heating, and possibly 2 degrees. And that's because of the lag in the atmospheric system. It's because we've left it so late. So they say we also need carbon drawdown. We need to draw down carbon dioxide, which has already been released, into the atmosphere. And until now, the most popular options were either this bioenergy with carbon capture and storage or direct air capture machines. And there's huge problems with both of those options. Bioenergy with carbon capture and storage basically means plantations, which you then harvest, you burn the wood in power stations, you theoretically capture the carbon dioxide from that burning, bury it in geological formations, and in theory you've created negative emissions, except you haven't. Because you're going to do one of two things in creating plantations on that scale. You are either going to replace a huge amount of arable land and create global starvation, or you're going to replace a huge amount of natural ecosystems and create global ecological meltdown.
Yeah, that's not a win-win.
No. It's a lose-lose. And the central scenario is, people have been talking about, is which is AR 4.6, which is, you're talking about an area three times the size of India being planted up with plantations. It's an absolute catastrophe.
Yeah.
But also, in converting that land, in churning the soil, in cutting the trees and the rest of it, you're going to release more greenhouse gases than you're ever likely to save through carbon capture and storage. So it just doesn't make any sense at all. It's a total disaster. Why anybody thought this was a good idea utterly defeats me.
Is that going ahead? Is that something that governments have signed up to?
Luckily, there's not a great deal of... There's a great deal of talk.
Yeah.
There's less activity so far.
The other
thing is the direct air capture, building these machines which are going to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Huge amounts of steel and concrete required. If you're going to do that on the scale where it's going to make a significant difference, the infrastructure you need to build could tip us over the threshold anyway and become one of the climate tipping points.
Yeah.
So what do you do instead? Because we need to draw down this carbon dioxide.
I was going to ask him that question.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that rewilding is the amazing fix which is going to do this for us. Because over the last couple of years, there's been a whole load of new science showing that ecological restoration, allowing forests to come back, peat bogs to come back, salt marshes, mangroves, has a massive potential beneficial climate impact. Because all that involves drawing down carbon from the atmosphere, turning it into organic carbon in the form of wood, in the form of saturated soils, in the form of root biomass, all the rest of it, which then locks up that carbon and would help us, could provide about one third of the total mitigation potential. It's absolutely huge. It turns out that restoring certain animal populations is also crucial. If wolves were allowed to reach their historic levels in North America once again, they would sequester every year the equivalent of emissions of about 50 million cars. But I know, isn't it incredible? By suppressing the herbivory of deer and moose and allowing forests to grow faster.
If Donald Trump,
yeah, well, that would be that would definitely help to prevent the climate yeah. breakdown from taking
anyway,
place.
Anyway, wolves aren't that bad. They're not going to eat anyone. We can't have that message going out.
No. Wolves, I mean, you're far more likely...
Keystone species are cool.
I mean, even in the wolf hotspots in North America, you're far more likely to be killed by a vending machine than you are by a wolf. This is a scientific fact.
Every year,
I mean, wolf attacks are about once every 30 years in North America. Every year, people are killed by vending machines.
They are dangerous. They carry knives.
They could be about to pounce on you at any time.
They form gangs, yeah.
You never know when you get it. Well, people shake them to get the money out.
Yeah.
And so... Wow. And it's not funny. This is tragic. This is a terrible tragedy. But wolves actually... Keep away from people for obvious reasons. Who wouldn't? But it turns out that predatory fish are absolutely crucial for the carbon sequestration on salt marshes because they suppress the populations of snails and herbivorous crabs, which eat the vegetation that holds the salt marsh together. And so it goes on. It turns out that these trophic cascades are absolutely crucial to carbon sequestration around the world. So what do we do to prevent climate breakdown? We restore ecosystems and we bring magnificent wildlife back.
Yes.
What's not to like? So, with this in mind, a couple of weeks ago, a few of us launched our Natural Climate Solutions campaign. We got a website called naturalclimate.solutions.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to do is to pool all the science, show what's... Show the latest thinking and then direct people to the organisations around the world which are doing the best work on this.
So what's the best way for us to get involved in that? Like, you know,
well, so
you can,
so
you
we
can obviously
we,
share the content
because we're
of the
just
website.
A small group of volunteers, we don't have any capacity to engage people ourselves. But so what we've done is to list all those organisations which are best placed to do that. And in Britain, I helped to found it, so I do have a vested interest in this, but Rewilding Britain is taking this on in a big way. It's trying to really, I mean, its current work, as well as trying to launch a big rewilding scheme in Mid Wales at the moment, is to press the government specifically to change the farm subsidy scheme, because with Brexit we got this opportunity, not just towards this vague public money for public goods thing that Gove is already talking about, but specifically for ecological restoration, rewilding, especially when it can be shown to have major carbon sequestration impacts.
Is that part of the new environment bill that they're writing?
Not yet.
But that could be something that...
Well, so the subsidy, the subsidy system is in the agricultural bill. Mm. The commitment is there, public money for public goods. A lot of it is payments for not mugging old ladies, which is a bit of an issue. You know, it's like we're going to pay people not to do the things they shouldn't be doing anyway. And there is sort of a slight social justice issue there. But, you know, we want to go much well beyond that and say, you know, let's pay people to do really positive things in terms of rewilding, mass sort of earth systems level restoration in terms of restoring watersheds, restoring soils, and bringing back spectacular wildlife, including many species which are currently missing from the United Kingdom.
And perhaps with the announcement of a climate emergency, an ask could be to stop subsidising fossil fuels and start subsidising rewilding.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Let's do that.
Yay.
So I've been given a 5-minute warning for this section, so I think
already.
So let's we have another. We're going to have a break here, some more music from Olivia, and then we've got a whole hour and a half still for questions. So loads of the topics that we're going to cover, we can talk about with you as well. But let's talk about the youth climate strikes and Extinction Rebellion, because they have been so key in what's been an epic few weeks, and really does seem to have shifted. Is that a tipping point? And I know you've been so heartened by it. Tell us a little bit more about what it is that's giving you hope. I mean, I think we can see that tonight. But
well, I have to say, when I went to the first school's climate strike, the local school children had asked me to come along and speak at it. I cried. It was so moving. It was so inspiring to see in my home city a couple of thousand children coming out with these beautiful banners, some of them very funny.
Yeah. Great humour, really good humour.
Really amazing, yeah. Super well informed and some amazing articulate speakers. And I just thought, this is it. This, I'm seeing change happen in front of my eyes. And the incredible presence of Greta Thunberg, who is, you know, like our Joan of Arc, you know, she's really changing things big time. And what it says to me is that change comes from the most unexpected places. Who would have thought a 15-year-old Swedish schoolgirl was going to swing this?
Totally.
It's just amazing, isn't it? And so, you know, and this reinforces my feeling that despair is never an appropriate response. Mm. It's never an appropriate response because, A, you simply don't know what's around the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there have been many bleak years where it just seems, oh, my God, we're not going to do anything. We're just trapped in this. People aren't going to change. And then suddenly things happen. Mm. I mean, politics proceeds by punctuated equilibria, long periods of stasis followed by sudden rupture. Mm. And at the moment, we're in a period of sudden rupture, as the news this evening shows, and anything could happen. And we've indulged ourselves in despair very often in this country. Now, despair leads to inaction. Mm. And the Christians are right about this. Despair is a sin. Because we can afford not to act, because we're in a relatively, well, a very rich country. We're buffered. We're in a temperate country. But our inaction condemns other people to destitution and death. Our inaction forces other people to act, leaving their homes, getting involved in a civil war, whatever it might be, driven by climate breakdown. We can afford not to act, they cannot. And so, you know, there have been a lot of people saying, oh, you know, we have to embrace despair, we have to accept despair, we just have to recognise it, you know, the situation for what it is and recognise there's no hope. Well, number one, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say there's no hope, there is no hope. But you know, number two, you know, it's all very well for us to say that, but actually it's not us whose lives are most immediately on the line. It is the poor of the world who get hit first and who get hit worst. But number three, you can't say there is no hope because you cannot see the future. You cannot see what is coming. And the incredible thing that the youth climate strikes and Extinction Rebellion have unleashed was completely unpredicted by everybody. It took me by surprise, you know, and I like to have my ear to the ground on these things. You know, I could see what they were doing, and I really hoped that it was going to turn into something really big, but my hopes have been raised so many times and dashed so many times that I didn't expect it.
Yeah.
But it happened.
And I think with Greta in particular, from her, it came very quickly from grief into action. It's like she bypassed, despair was just like not on her radar.
Yeah.
And straight into you know, rage, and like with Extinction Rebellion, it's love and rage, it's action. But I think despair, you know, is something that we come close to. With, you know, it's
grief is fine. Grief is all right. You know, grief is totally understandable and acceptable. You know, and getting down about it is totally understandable and acceptable. Being depressed about it is, but that's not the same as despair. Despair is something different. Despair is giving up. Despair is the flip side of denial. It has exactly the same impact. And in fact, I've been struck by the number of people who have gone straight from denial to despair without anything in between, where it starts off where they say, it's not happening, it's not happening, it's not happening. And then they say, OK, it is happening, but it's too late to do anything about it. And not for one moment in between did they say, it's happening and therefore we ought to act.
Yeah.
Despair's a cop-out, just like denial. It's a get-out clause. It's to tell yourself you've got no agency. But my God, we have got agency. If a 15-year-old schoolgirl's got agency, we have got agency.
Yeah. The title of tonight's event was Join the Dots Between Consumerism, Climate Change and Mental Health. I have already joined the dots between the first two a long time ago, probably with every other person in this room. I was really, really interested to hear how the last was linked to the first two. In fact, it was the reason I'm here tonight with my son, who's actually now left. I didn't expect any amazing panacea, but I expected some more, say, insightful opinion and possibly get some discussion now. I certainly expected more than despair is a sin. Easy to say, but in doing so, you write off a real anxiety felt by countless young people who may not be here tonight, nor in Bristol, nor in this country. Do you have any comments, George?
Thank you. Yes, well, we didn't actually get round to... I mean, it's my fault. I went on so long with the answers I gave that we didn't get round to that crucial part of the discussion, which was the mental health issues. And it is... there's a whole load of ways in which you can come into this. First of all, unquestionably now, there is a real phenomenon of anxiety about climate and environmental breakdown leading to mental health conditions. This has been well documented. There's even therapists now specialising in attending to these conditions, and it is totally rational and understandable that we should respond to this with anxiety disorders, for example. I mean, if we, in a way, if we're not suffering from the grief and fear that these issues invoke, we haven't been paying attention. But there's also ways in which our mental health pandemic, the crisis, which is now afflicting the entire planet. The Lancet published a report end of last year looking at how this pandemic of mental health disorders is sweeping across the planet. I believe that there are common roots between that and the environmental crisis that we face, because I think that both are driven to a large extent by particular models of consumerism. Now, you know, I don't want to make too hard a linkage between this, because there are clear divergences as well. But a big part of the mental health crisis that we face, the global pandemic that we face, is caused by alienation, particularly alienation from each other. This is the age of loneliness, the age of atomization. And Ewan, who I think is in the audience, my collaborator on the album, Breaking the Spell of Loneliness, we toured around the country to try to discuss this huge existential crisis of the splitting apart of this most social of all mammals, and to try to bring people together, to actually try to break that spell. Now, this crisis has been propelled to a large extent by an atomizing ideology which tells us we ought to be apart, that we are lone rangers, sole traders, self-made men and women, we are individuals, and has quite deliberately tried to split us apart in order to atomize and rule. And this particular variant of capitalism called neoliberalism, which is the dominant ideology of our times, has to treat us as entirely individuated beings, has to effectively destroy society in order to allow an economic and political elite free reign. And when Mrs. Thatcher said there is no such thing as society, that was in a way the central manifesto of that creed. Now, it's this same driving force which has been the great accelerant of climate breakdown and environmental breakdown. It has been the monetization of human relations, the instrumentalization of our relationship with each other and with the living world. It has been to treat the living world itself as another form of capital, natural capital. This absurd, destructive, crazy term. It's a meaningless term apart from anything else, because capital is a human-made portion of wealth which is used in the pursuit of further profit. You simply cannot have natural capital. It can't even exist as a concept, as capital is conceived. But it's this attempt to commodify everything, including human relations. And I believe that, alongside some of the catastrophic impacts of social media, I mean, I think social media's got many virtues, but it's also this incredibly powerful means of comparison and powerful means of seeking approval, which is a very strong human instinct, is to seek approval. And it gives you, it's this variable reward syndrome, which makes it quite addictive. How many people here, hand on heart, how many people here think they use social media too much? How many people here think they use social media too little? About three, thank you. How many people here think they use it just about right? I think too much wins that by quite a big margin, doesn't it? This is a highly addictive form of consumerism that they've hooked us into, and it's one that sets us apart. It seems to connect us as human beings, but in many ways it sets us apart. And it helps to drive, because of course it's very advertising focused, it helps to drive a further hyper-consumerism. So what I'm trying to show here, and what we did intend to talk about in the first half, and I'm very sorry that we didn't get to it, but what I'm trying to show here is that the crises we're discussing, the mental health crisis and the environmental crisis, are driven to a large extent by the same factors and are weaponized by celebrity. Celebrity, this feature, as I said in the first half, which seems to be detached from stuff, turns out to be absolutely central to the model, to the extent that a celebrity is now president of the United States. Yeah. This is the society of the spectacle, exactly as Guy Debord forecast. It is remarkably prescient book in, 1968, 69, The Society of the Spectacle. And he described how we are living today. And when you look at the way that the media portrays the issues that confront us. It's all about personalization. It's all about the spectacularization of politics and of public life, rather than the substance of what is actually happening. Now, there's a particular political faction that thrives on spectacularization, that is all about spectacle, all about symbol, all about sensation, all about slogans, rather than substance, and that faction is called fascism. And the resurgence of proto-fascism, of the sort of Trump, Duterte, Erdogan, Orban, Le Pen, Farage variety, and of real actual fascism, which is beginning to emerge in many parts of the world, is driven to a very large extent by the spectacularization of politics and of the media, which creates openings for the political movement which uses spectacle above and beyond everything else that weren't previously there. The media and its political coverage has got a huge amount to answer for. You know, we know that Donald Trump is a reality TV star. So is Nigel Farage. So is Jacob Rees-Mogg. So is Boris Johnson. Except the reality TV platform they have is not The Apprentice, it's BBC News and Current Affairs. Particularly Question Time. And all this, sorry, I know it's a very long answer, but it's because it's a missing chunk, yeah. So I'm really sorry to go on about this. But all this contributes to this alienation, not only from each other, but also from social forces and from political change, which I think also feeds strongly into the mental health crisis, as indeed does our alienation from nature. And there are a whole series of studies now showing that children brought up without much access to nature are far more prone to anxiety disorders and depression than children brought up with access to a lot of green spaces. We need it. It's part of the warp and weft of our humanity. And so not only do the same factors drive both crises, but the one crisis contributes to the other crisis. That is the linkage that I would make. Sorry to go on so long.
Not at all. It's really, really important. And I'm sorry that your son wasn't here. Hopefully he can watch it. This is all being filmed. It will be available on social media, and hopefully he can watch it. I would like...
There we are. We're trapped.
I would like to add to that. I mean, like picking up on that. Yeah, Brits spend 94% of our time indoors. So I think that is a huge part of the eco-anxiety, is actually quite often getting out into it can help restore your sense of sanity and well-being. And also the fact that, you know, for the past 5-10 years, we've been bombarding ourselves and our teenagers and our children with microwave radiation in the form of 3G, 4G, now possibly 5G. It's controversial, but these things have been shown to cause and been linked to teenage suicide. There's some really interesting reports on that. So I think we also need to look about, you know, not just what's going on out there, but what's going on in our homes and in our bodies and how we're looking after ourselves, so that we can be resilient, but also that we are aware of the technology that we're immersing ourselves in, and obviously using it for social media. So I wanted to add that into that, because it is part of the conversation, I believe, around our well-being and mental health. Thanks. And also there's some really fantastic Bristol projects which people can get involved in to reduce that sense of alienation and to help that sense. We've got such an amazing community here in Bristol and such a sense of so many fantastic projects that people can go and get involved with and really connect with each other. So before we end tonight, we will do a quick fire round of some, and I'd love you to be shouting out some of the projects. I'll shout out some of them that we can all go and get involved with. So we'll move on to the next question. I've got a woman here in the sort of mid...
Okay,
great. Thank you very much.
Hi, thanks, George. It's been a really interesting evening. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, for someone like me who's a kind of a layman when it comes to politics and economics, what an alternative to capitalism might look like, and perhaps give your opinion on basic income and if that might be part of our future.
Thank you very much. Really important question. So I guess part of the reason why it took me so long to stop going on about corporate capitalism or consumer capitalism or crony capitalism or all these other varieties of capitalism and realise that the problem was not the adjective but the noun is that I didn't have a clearly formulated alternative with which to replace it. But I gradually became aware that actually these are initially separate questions. The first step is to recognise that regardless of what particular variety of capitalism you're facing, capitalism is destroying the living planet. And if it's a sort of social democratic capitalism, it might take a few years longer than if it's a neoliberal capitalism. But it's still heading in exactly the same direction, and for two fundamental reasons. The first of these reasons is that it's intimately associated with economic growth. If growth fails, capitalism fails. Economic growth is the aggregate of the drive to increase your capital stake and the profits that you derive from it. So you can't have capitalism without economic growth, though, as state communism showed, you can have economic growth without capitalism, but it's integral to the capitalist model. The second, perhaps even more powerful capitalist driver is the assumption which underlies it. It's absolutely central to capitalism, even though it's a largely unacknowledged assumption, and it's a fundamentally Lockean one, which says that a person is entitled to as much natural wealth as their money can buy. If you've got the money, or indeed if you can borrow the money, you can buy as much land as you want. You can buy a private jet and use as much atmospheric space as you want through your greenhouse gas emissions. You can eat rare fish and steak. You can basically grab as much of the living world for yourself as you want. This concept is also integral, intrinsic to capitalism. So the first step, which we can say without any qualification, is that capitalism is destroying our life support systems. The second step is more difficult, to say, so therefore we need to replace capitalism with, and that's where it gets a little hazier. Now, at the moment, I've got several first steps towards that, I feel. One is the fantastic work done by Jeremy Lent with his book, The Patterning Instinct, and his beginnings of a formulation of an ecological civilization using a completely different worldview to the Western capitalist mindset which has become universalized around the world. It's a fantastic work of cognitive history and of future visioning, which I would recommend to everyone, The Patterning Instinct by Jeremy Lent. Another part of the equation, I feel, is provided by Kate Raworth's Donut Economics, another crucial text which, again, everyone in this area should read. I feel that there are further clues in this concept I've been trying to develop, which is I call private sufficiency, public luxury. If everyone tries to pursue private luxury, there is simply not enough physical or ecological space in order to do it. If everyone in Bristol sought to have their own tennis court, their own swimming pool, their own play barn, their own art gallery, Bristol would occupy the whole of the southwest. Then where would everyone else live? I mean, you physically can't do it. And yet the pursuit of private luxury is what the whole system is based around. Simply can't be done. Let alone on the ecological side. You know, we talked in the first half about what's happening there with our pursuit of private luxury. However, if we pursue public luxury, magnificent public swimming pools and tennis courts and parks and play spaces and all the rest of it, then the more we pursue it, the more space we create for everyone. Whereas pursuing private luxury, you reduce the space available for everyone else. With public luxury, you increase it. And I think tying in the donut economics and the ecological civilization ideas with that concept could be very powerful. Similarly, with this fundamental right that I'm trying to push for, which is, it's this simple, it says every generation everywhere should have an equal right to enjoy natural wealth, which automatically starts to sort of resonate in terms of you can't continue to use any resource which is irreplaceable. You have to basically leave as much on Earth at the end of your time on Earth as there was at the beginning. It fundamentally changes our relationship with the living world. Now, what I don't have is an ism, which I can just pluck off the shelf and say, this is the answer. I'm not a state communist. I never was. I see enormous problems with that, and not least the ecological problems that it caused. Huge ecological problems, but of course also a whole lot of other massive issues. I don't see any ready-made ideology which actually answers our ecological and humanitarian crisis, including the crisis of alienation that leads to our mental health crisis. So we have to create one. And this is a project to which I feel we should all be bending our minds. The era of the grand old man scratching his beard and coming up with the answer is over.
Which is possibly where the citizen assemblies aspect can come in through the Extinction Rebellion's sort of third request. That could be a way that
we This is absolutely crucial. Absolutely crucial. I mean, it is preposterous. We have this representative system. A purely representative system. And I think we need representative democracy as well as participatory democracy. But the representative system is based on presumed consent. So the Prime Minister can say, for instance, look, I got a mandate to push through the third runway at Heathrow. He says, sorry, where was your mandate? Well, I won the last election. You say, well, number one, I didn't vote for you. Yeah. Number two, only 30% of the country did or something. Number three, if it was in your manifesto, it was on page 71 at the bottom and no one read it. We didn't vote for that. A majority, or rather a large minority, might have voted for your government, but they didn't vote for that. You have no mandate for that. You haven't put it to the people. Now, I know that referendums are falling out of fashion at the moment. But there are a whole load of really fantastic new digital democratic participatory tools being developed around the world. Citizens' Assemblies is one, very powerful one, very important one. The stuff they're doing in Reykjavik with the Better Reykjavik programme, where basically the whole city runs the city, is another brilliant thing. Participatory budgeting, first designed in Porto Alegre in Brazil, another one. There are so many of these brilliant new ways of organising society running alongside representative democracy. Why the hell don't we use them? We don't accept presumed consent when it comes to sex. Why do we accept it in politics?
Let's take another question.
Hi, my question's sort of a little bit like which came first, the chicken or the egg, but I know in your last book you talk a lot about education and like the right direction that education could go for in terms of mental health particularly, in terms of like mental health particularly, but like which comes first? Is it an education system that promotes, you know, people being able to fill their full attributes, or is it inequality that comes first and being able that everyone, no matter what background you have, is able to achieve, you know, what the attributes is? Which comes first? Do you tackle inequality or an education system that can benefit everyone regardless of economic background?
Thank you. Well, thank you. It's a really crucial question. I mean, I don't know the answer to which comes first. I would say that they are intimately connected and both have to be attended to. And they're connected because an unequal society needs a justifying ethic, which is that we are born unequal. And some people deserve to be at the bottom and some people deserve to be at the top. And so it creates an educational system that reflects that justifying ethic. Otherwise, the proles will get uppity and they'll come and take our stately homes. You know, that's the approach, basically, that has been driving educational policy. A lot of it based on straightforward scientific fraud. justifying selective education. Now, my big complaint about the education system, which I articulated in my last book, was that it recognises only one variety of intelligence. Now, I was very lucky because it just happened that my variety of intelligence was the kind that it recognised. Yeah, you know, I got an analytical mind, a very linear mind. I'm hyperlexic. You know, I started reading from a very early age. I'm totally comfortable with the written word. But that's a very specific and particular kind of intelligence. And after I left school, I found that faced with almost any other situation, I'm a complete klutz. Whereas many of the friends I've subsequently made were written off as complete klutzes at school, but turn out to be geniuses. Because they've got a kind of intelligence which wasn't recognised at school. For instance, a friend of mine is dyslexic. He was never diagnosed as such at school, he was just told he was thick. Now, this is one of the most intelligent people I know. And he's got an almost supernatural ability to diagnose mechanical issues. Any machine, any engine, anything with moving parts, anywhere where I become immediately lost, he could just home in and say, OK, the problem's here, what you need to do is this. And he could just see it all in 3D. He's got this spatial mind. I'm spatial needs. I can't picture 3D images at all. And my, you know, and when it comes to map reading, I'm just all over the place. I just can't do it because my mind works in a very particular way. His works in a totally different way. But if you were to say, I'm brighter than him, you can't make that judgment because he is as intelligent in his field as I am in mine. And as all of you are in a particular direction, which might in some cases never have been discovered because it's not being sought in school or for that matter in the workplace. And it's this very particular linear approach which is, you know, takes you places but is also limiting. You know, I recognise that I've got very severe limitations in the way I see the world. It's sort of helpful to me in that I've got this very targeted, linear, focused approach, but it means I miss a lot of stuff. I'm not seeing a lot of stuff on the edge of vision, which other people do see and are able, because they can see it, to make great creative leaps. So why is it that with all this bloody testing at school, all the SATs and all the rest of it, we're just constantly being assessed on one axis, and all the other ways in which human beings are intelligent? Because let's face it, you know, when during evolutionary history, if you had a small group of people who all thought in exactly the same way, you were going to be toast. You had to have lots of ways of looking at the world, lots of different ways of perceiving what was around you, to use that hive mind, that collective genius, that social genius, which is what humans are so good at, in order to survive and prosper. And yet, that is basically being persecuted. That neural difference, that difference of approach, of vision, of outlook, is stamped out at school. And that limits our possibilities. And so what we get then is a ruling class, political and economic elite, which has only one way of looking at the world, because they're the people who have been selected, like me. And that way is incredibly limiting and shuts off an enormous range of possibilities that we need to explore, because now, frankly, yet again, our survival depends on it. Mm. Our survival depends on neural and cognitive diversity. And isn't it interesting that the new 16-year-old leader of all this has got Asperger's?
I think it affirms the importance of us all discovering our unique voice and not feeling like we have to be George, or for me feeling like I have to be John
Heaven
Humphreys
forbid.
Tonight.
Yeah.
You know, it's about us us being who we are. Yeah. And you know, like I tried to read Kate Raworth's book. I really tried, and I just couldn't. And I really tried to read Naomi Klein's her more recent one, and I only got halfway through. Like, there is a real place for communicating these things in a really accessible way. And I'm not
it's not about dumbing it down. It's just diversity, different approaches. So the artists, I think recently, you know, even with Extinction Rebellion, the Red Rebels, you know, just expressing things
in
a different way. You know, it reaches people and it touches people and it breaks beyond that. And I would love for our education system to keep breaking through that. And there are some really good campaigns around abolishing SATs and things. If education is your passion, then get in there and disrupt it, I would say. Let's take another question. So we'll welcome a question from... let's take a question from another woman. Over here at the back, have we got someone?
Hello.
Oh.
Hi, George. Unfortunately, the polls have voted. Trump is president. UK want to leave the EU. As hilarious as it all is, these are the votes of the people. You're preaching to the converted in this room right now. Earlier, you made light of the small changes that people have made on social media for enacting change. How do you, George, think we should enact change that will affect the majority of people who aren't fortunate enough to be here today?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Great question. I would challenge one of its premises. I mean, you know, I don't think that either Trump or Brexit are the work of the proles, so to speak. I would say that these are elite projects.
I don't know what a prole is. Can we
Well, proletariat, I mean, you know, the
just in case someone else in the room.
So it basically, it's
out of all 500 of you, doesn't know what a prole is.
A prole is a heuristic for the working class. That's what it means.
What is heuristic?
Oh, sorry, a shortcut. Sorry. Yeah, it's a shortcut way of saying working class people. Derives from the word proletarian.
Thanks. I'm from a working class background.
That's probably why
I didn't know what it meant.
No, sure. And so, sorry, it's my very linear form
of... Good. It's good, that's
so,
why I'm here.
And, you know, these are both elite projects, but of course they did gather a lot of popular support as well. So, preaching to the converted. Who else do you preach to? Who else is going to sit there for long enough while you preach at them?
Yeah, well, people do it in Cavern Circus, and they'll stand there and they'll preach all day, but no one stops to listen.
Look, there's this fundamental misconception about how political change works. And the misconception is that the people you must reach are the people furthest away from you. No political changes ever happen that way. The way it works is that you create a powerful core of people. Mm-hmm. People equipped with knowledge, with insight, with ideas, with tools, with strategies. And part of what we're doing tonight is equipping each other with those and pushing it forward and pushing our ideas forward, pushing our drive towards collective action forward. And then that small core infects the minds of the next circle. And then you reach the next concentric circle and you move outwards from there. This is how all political change has always happened. And according to the work of the historian Erica Chenoweth, the maximum number of people you need dedicated to civil disobedience, civil protest, to radically change society is 3.5%. Now, why should this be? The answer is that most people, most of the time, are not politically involved, not in any active way. You know, most people might vote in some elections, probably not tomorrow. Most people might read a paper occasionally, but actual political commitment, being fully politically engaged and active, this is a minority pursuit. And yet the minority that pursues it ends up running the world. The world is run by the people who turn up. And what people who aren't so active are constantly doing is just looking out subconsciously, this all happens subliminally, for where the social currents are going. This is what we've always done. This is what being a socially minded creature is all about. We're constantly attuned to the rest of society. And because fitting in is a very important human survival skill, we're always subconsciously listening out for where the status quo might be and how it's changing. And if you get a small-ish core of people, 2%, 3%, 3.5%, fully committed to a wholly new position and promoting that and pushing it into people's minds again and again and again, people perceive that society has shifted, and suddenly you get these tipping points in politics, boom, everyone falls in line with it, almost everybody. And what you see again and again is that certain powerful political narratives capture the public mind and become dominant. We saw it with Keynesianism, we saw it with neoliberalism. People have been listening for the new narrative. And finally, I think we're beginning to hear it. And I think we are starting to see this shift. I mentioned before about how politics proceeds by punctuated equilibria, long periods of stasis, followed by sudden rupture. We are in a period of sudden rupture. And what we need is the committed 2, 3, or 3.5% to turn that into massive political change.
Wow. Well, 3.5% is not a lot, is it?
It's not a lot. It really isn't a lot. But what Erica Chenoweth has done is looked at civil rights movement, anti-apartheid movement, suffragettes, the sort of big political shifts driven by civil movements across recent history, and come up, this is the maximum number of people you need to make
Which
it happen.
It gives me hope. It's heartening to think that actually, you know, in terms of the population of the UK, like, that's really achievable, like, especially with Extinction Rebellion. I'm going to admit it started off feeling a bit fringe, and I've definitely had my full crusty hippie phase in my life. Anyone who wants to search through my Facebook photos will find it. But, you know, initially it felt like it wasn't inclusive, and that we couldn't all go down to Turbo Island and join in a sort of Stokescroft family-friendly Extinction Rebellion. But the more of us that actually join in and that make it, you know, that change the stereotypes, that join in with it, that it quite quickly becomes more normal, and the more of us that are sharing it, then it does normalise it and tell that new narrative, which is exciting. So I'd like to hear from a woman, or if anyone identifies as non-binary, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
I've got a woman here with her arm firmly raised in the air.
Sorry to disrupt the flow there, but we do want to make sure that women are fully represented, and anyone who identifies as non-binary as well.
Well,
thank you.
I'm a woman and have a microphone, so maybe I should.
All right.
Wow,
all right. Okay. Okay. We'll go you and then you. Okay.
That's okay. No worries. So I'm actually a mental health nurse as well, and I work for the NHS. And I agree with a lot of what you've said about alienation being a factor. I think you could probably join the dots even more directly and just sum it up as capitalism, because if we look at absolute and relative poverty, that's often underlying a lot of mental health issues, you come to all of that. But that's a global issue and not just an issue in the UK. So if we think about capitalism, and if we're to stop growth, which you were saying would be one of the responses, then surely we would want to say we actually need to redistribute growth. And does that have to be a zero-sum game? Because if we look at the global south, we would want their standards of living and their growth to increase, and they're often disproportionately affected by climate change. So how do we share out those resources and allow massive growth in some parts of the world while stopping overall economic growth globally to prevent further disruption of climate?
Thank you. Another great question. Now, of course, you're absolutely right. I mean, the colonised parts of the world, which have been deprived of their own wealth by imperialism that continues today under the name of trade, have huge populations whose basic living standards are not met. And this is where I think donut economics is so useful, because what Kate Raworth does is to visualise the way in which we can meet basic living standards without exceeding planetary boundaries, and that is the donut. The basic living standards are the hole into which you don't want to fall. Below that standard, the outside ring is the planetary boundaries that you don't want to breach. Now, I think the weakness of the book, and I'm sure she would see this herself, is turning that into actual concrete prescriptions for economic policy. And there's still a huge amount of work to be done with this, but I agree that there needs to be equitable growth in the poorest parts of the world, whereas we actually need degrowth in the richest parts of the world. And in order to do that, you do need a completely different economic system. Because at the moment, the poorest parts of the world are told, well, your means of growing is to trade with us in the rich world. Now, already, that trade has managed to deprive the poorest parts of the world of their resources, of their labour, of their land, of their soil, of their water. It's been devastating to many parts of the world in either the short immediate term or in the long run when environmental crisis becomes ever more urgent. And, you know, it's always the poor who do get hit most. So there's going to have to be, I think, less global trade if there's going to be any chance of more equitable development, not least because the rich nations manage unequally to capture the great majority of the benefits of global trade. But there will have to be sort of regional and national trade to allow poorer nations to be able to raise people above that crucial basic floor of need. Now, I don't have all the answers either, and I'm not sure anyone yet has all the answers for what those economies might look like. But there are some brilliant examples being developed around the world. Examples of how you increase people's wealth on the land while keeping the soil on the land. Examples of how you actually increase people's prosperity at the same time as restoring ecosystems, and often the two things are essential. A very good example is looking at fisheries, for example. Now, at the moment, European boats go down to West Africa and ransack people's fisheries, all in the name of trade. And we're told, oh, well, this is enriching people because, look, you know, we'll pay some docking rights and fish processing and the rest of it. What it's doing is starving people. People should be able to take back control of their fisheries, create marine reserves where fish can breed and grow to large sizes once more, and then you get this spillover effect into the surrounding waters, and you gradually increase natural wealth and increase people's levels of subsistence. These aren't in any way whole answers, but what I can say is that the current way of doing things is going to meet neither need. It's neither going to protect us from environmental breakdown, nor is it going to ensure that the people who have been so cruelly deprived of their subsistence today have their basic needs met. So, the other woman with a question there, yes, thank you.
Oh, I don't know if it's... Oh, hello. Hi. So I'd like to talk about mental health, but specifically within rural communities, because farmers... So I interview farmers as part of my research every day, and quite often they mention how they do feel demonised and berated, you know, about everything almost, you know, about their practices, about the environment, climate change. Often they feel completely to blame for it. And that is actually having huge impacts on their mental health. Farmer suicide rates are incredibly high. There's at least one suicide a week just in the UK of farmers. So I completely agree, obviously, that we need radical changes in our environment. But how can we do that without causing irreparable damage to our rural communities?
Mm-hmm. Well... Thank you. Another very good question. I mean, currently the incentive structure is completely wrong. You know, all the incentives are basically knock six kinds of hell out of your land to make as much profit as quickly as you can, because otherwise you're going to be outcompeted. And the subsidy system drives out the small farmers while rewarding the rich farmers. You get paid by the hectare. How insane is this? The more land you own, the more public money you are given. And what this means is it stacks up the economies of scale even more against the small and medium-sized farmers, who are the ones committing suicide. It's not the very rich people who are committing suicide, it's the small people on the receiving end of all that. And it's crazy. But nor is farming meeting our needs, because, you know, it's still providing a sort of 1950s diet in this country when our needs have shifted. So those of us who have made the switch to a plant-based diet are having to import most of the food we eat. Britain's actually a really great place for growing pulses. We could grow all sorts of edible pulses here, but we aren't doing so because we're still locked into the old ways of doing things. And, you know, some farmers are slow to change, but also the incentive structure is slow to change. Now, you know, what I've always tried to do is to say, look, there's a lot wrong with farming, but you can't blame the individual farmers for that. Well, some of them actually do behave appallingly, it's true. You know, there's a huge range of practice among farmers. There's some very good ones, there are some very bad ones. And were we to judge farming by the standards we judge any other industry, we would be a lot tighter with the regulations. You know, by far and away, the biggest source of river pollution in Britain now is dairy farming. If there was the same amount of industrial pollution coming from chemicals factories wiping out the life of our rivers, there'd be riots on the streets. But somehow we give it a free pass. Now, again, I'm not blaming the individual farmers for that. I'm blaming a complete regulatory failure on the part of government. And what that regulatory failure does is to create an uneven playing field, because it basically means that the bad farmers, the people who are prepared to cut corners, the unscrupulous ones, are going to prosper in that situation, whereas the good farmers who are really trying to do the right thing are going to be trampled. And, you know, if you know that you're doing the right thing and you're losing as a result, that really can drive you over the edge. I mean, that's a terrible combination to have to deal with cognitively. And so, you know, it's the system, again, that is wrong. And the problem is, you know, you look at the House of Commons, you look even more at the House of Lords, it's governed by huge landowners. Guy Shrubsole's book, published this week, Who Owns England? A fantastic book, crucial book, really beautifully written, by the way, and full of amazing information, shows that, you know, we think we're a modern democracy, but we're still run by the aristocracy. I mean, we really are. You know, they own about a third of England. And then the next tier of these sort of massive non-aristocratic but sort of landed gentry type own at least another 20% or so. Yeah, and I think it's like 25,000 people own half of England. It's quite astonishing. You know, something is seriously wrong here. And these people are massively overrepresented in Parliament. You know, there are MPs with tens of thousands of acres of land. There are lords with even more who have a hereditary right to sit in judgment over the rest of us. The whole system is crocked. So it's the system that we have to change.
A mass movement like, say, Extinction Rebellion and, say, the 3.5 of us get involved, is that enough to change the system? Or is it still going to be the same people making the decisions and like, oh, well, we'll add this and we'll give you a little bit of a participatory thing and we'll give you a little bit of that? Like, is that enough to change the system?
Well, it depends what you're trying to change. I mean, and we can't rely on Extinction Rebellion to change everything. I mean, already there are all these people say, oh, you know, Extinction Rebellion, it's too white, it's too middle class, it's too friendly with the police. And you say, look, it's tough enough being an environmental activist without actually having to change your skin colour at the same time. You know, it's like, yeah, absolutely, I would love to see more people of colour there. But, you know, can you think of any reasons why people of colour might not want to join a heavily policed protest. Yeah, it's, you know, we're asking Extinction Rebellion to change everything, whereas they've got their work cut out trying to focus public attention on the environmental crisis, and they're doing that incredibly well. Now, if other people want to do something on a similar scale to change these other things, like the exclusion of people of colour, which is a huge issue, which desperately needs to be dealt with, like our political crisis where, you know, many people feel they're not being represented at all, then absolutely, we are free to do that and create movements to do that, but just don't expect Extinction Rebellion to do everything.
But I think
that's where political passivity comes in, and where we say, oh, those people out there could do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're a shining example here in Bristol of where voting Green can actually make a difference. Mm. And in terms of us passing a climate emergency months ago in Bristol, well done, Carla Denyer, if she's in the room, for that, saying that Bristol will be climate neutral by 2030. And it remains to be seen how we'll do that, but I think there is still a lot to be done in terms of local politics. So I think we've got like one more question. Have we got someone teed up there?
Someone teed up.
Take it from this gentleman over here. All right, we'll take a quick one. We'll do a quick two and you're on after
yourself. Someone's got the mic at the back.
Yep, already. Sure, go ahead.
Hello? Yeah, hi.
Hi.
So you talked about advertising and social media and connecting it to the control of independent thinking. Recently I came across, well, I was introduced to an article by Corey Morningstar, who's written a really interesting piece on the art, called The Art of Annihilation, who talks about the Extinction Rebellion movement and social media, and I'm interested in a comment from you on her work and talking a little bit about developing that point on how we stay awake and aware of the powers that are trying to control civil disobedience itself, and the people who are writing the policies that are trying to cash in on green consumerism. Mm.
Thank you. Well, Corey Morningstar made some interesting points. Unfortunately, she mixed them with these outrageous and false conspiracy theories about Greta Thunberg, claiming that she was basically a puppet being controlled by adults who had created her. And, I mean, there have been a load of horrible smears against this Swedish schoolgirl made by adults. And I have to say that Corey Morningstar's were some of the worst. Now, you know, that's a real shame, because some of the things she was saying were worth hearing. But why adults feel this urge to try to tear down this 16-year-old with Asperger's just defeats me. It's extraordinary. It's in The Spectator, it's in Spike magazine, it's in The Telegraph, it's all over the place. People just ripping into her, coming up with these appalling conspiracy theories, which, you know, Greta herself has had to respond to and says, well, you know, basically they're just completely made up. You know, because how could a 15-year-old possibly have been thinking for herself? There must have been some dark forces manipulating her. There must have been some, all these dodgy adults sort of turning her into their tool. It's the most disgusting, patronising, anti-youth, misogynistic approach that I've seen in a very long time, and I'm just really sorry that Corey Morningstar wrapped herself up in that. However, there are some very important points about the commodification of dissent and about the way in which almost anything can be captured if we're not super careful about that. We have to be on our guard. I mean, a classic example was the Pepsi advert with... what was her name? One of the Kardashian clan...
Kim?
No, not Kim Kardashian. One of the other ones. Who's that? Kylie Jenner. Yes, thank you. Kylie Jenner. sort of crossing police lines with her can of Pepsi. You know, as a way of saying, I'm a rebel because I drink Pepsi, not Coke.
Oh, fuck that.
Yeah, well, I know. Yeah. And so, you know, they're always on the sniff, the advertisers. They're always sniffing around the social trends. You know, I was talking about people, our social mind being attuned to change. Well, you know, the advertisers, they want to be in there first. Mm. And they want to capture the zeitgeist, or the shitegeist, as it now gets called, and get the sort of in on that social moment before it's widely adopted, so that they can commodify and commercialise it. And of course, we have to resist that. We can do that without spreading conspiracy theories.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I think we'll just take this question from this gentleman over here. Keep trying.
Hello.
Hi.
To be very short, should I have children? Mm.
Good question.
Great question. Thank you.
Do you want to have children?
Well, look, no, it's a really crucial question, this. And look, I've got two children, and as literally...
Contrary to what's on the internet, because lots of people have interviewed George today, going, so you've got one daughter. I've heard it said to him three times. And he's got two.
I got two, yes. And there's not a day goes by when I don't think, was this the right thing to do? Not because there's anything wrong with my daughters. Look, I mean, I delight yeah. in my kids, but yeah, then I think of the world that I've brought them into, you know, and they didn't ask to be brought into this world, and it's a very scary world. Yeah, I'm proud of them. I mean, my eldest daughter organised her school climate strike, the first school climate strike, completely without any reference to me. It was like, yeah. Dad, butt out of this. This is mine.
Whereas fantastic. My son took the day off, if he could, and he was still flipping eggs at 5 to 11 when the clip when it was just about to start. So I booted him out the door. Yeah,
good for you. I mean, obviously, if she hadn't organised a school climate strike, I would have said, "Why can't you be one of them nice yeah. kids out on strike? Look at you in your uniform; it's disgusting." I worry massively for them. You know, it's like, yeah, I'll drop off at some point and I'll be, you know, I'll know nothing of what then happens. But to leave this horrendous legacy and to leave them to deal with it, to mop it up, it troubles me constantly. I don't know how to answer this question. Yes, of course, there's massive environmental impacts in having children, especially in a rich nation as well. So the only way of reconciling that is to bring them up as eco-warriors
yeah.
and to get them to fight the system.
You can't guarantee that, though.
You there can't. No they'll guarantee. Rebel. You they'll
might,
rebel.
You might give birth to another Greta. You might give birth to another Kim. Mm. You don't know what you're going to get.
They might run away from the circus and join the bank.
They might. But
like John Major did.
You know, fertility rates are decreasing, yeah. especially in the West. Potentially another cause of Wi-Fi and all the pesticides we're consuming. But I think that a great way to, you know, I would say if you want to have children or if the person that you're with wants to have children. Don't have more than two. Like 2.1, I think, is the sort of the sweet spot that we can survive.
That's quite difficult to achieve, though.
But well, 2.1, exactly, you know. Two and a cat. No, they're terrible for the environment. But also, you know, a really great way, if that is something that you're interested in, is to support women's rights and women's education in the Global South and really share those organisations, because it's been shown that women, girls who have access to a secondary school education have fewer children in life. So if there's a way that you can support that, I think that's something that we can all do to address the population issue.
So... I can't answer your question because it is your question and your partner or putative partner's question. But as a general social question, should we have children? It could be that the responsible answer is no. not so much because of any impacts that those children might have, but because of the impacts those children might feel. And we are bringing up any of our children into a terrifying world. A world where nothing is certain anymore, and that can be a good thing, because the old certainties have failed us.
Yeah.
We need uncertainty now. We need massive and rapid change. But it can also be a very bad thing indeed, as that change could be catastrophic. So, you know, maybe we should just stop. Maybe we should just decide that actually it doesn't make any sense to keep having children. It's not fair to keep having children. But if we do have children, and if we already have children, as I do, then we should do everything in our power to support them through the struggle against the forces destroying our life support systems.
Let's turn our attention back to you, George, and I'd like to kind of summarise a little bit, if we can. I mean, like, pretty big topics to summarise, but I'd also like us to look at, like, sort of the 10 things, really, that we can all do, and you can certainly have the last word. So maybe give me your top five things that people in the room this evening that we can all do to go away from here with a sense of what we can all do.
Gosh, well, the first thing I'd say is do nothing by yourself.
Hmm.
You know, it's the crucial lesson from all political change is it works when you combine with other people in a common purpose.
Yeah.
Just what the law's always trying to prevent you from doing.
Yeah.
But you get together with people who've got the same aims and you pursue those aims together. That's why, you know, preaching to the converted makes a lot of sense, because that's where we start. We're in a great position now because you can join Extinction Rebellion. You can join the youth strike if you're young enough. And that's, you know, something which makes my life a lot easier, because people are constantly saying, well, so where do we go for, you know, the happening place? Well, it's, you know, now we know exactly where to go. You know, these two groups between them have changed the political landscape in this country, but the real struggle has just begun, because initiating it, that's hard enough, but sustaining it mm-hmm. is even harder. And, you know, even if you're not young enough to join the youth climate strike, those young people are going to need a lot of support. They're going to need social support. They're going to need psychological support. They're going to need logistical support. And so, you know, help in any way you can. Parents can help. People who aren't parents can help. Extinction Rebellion is going to need a lot of numbers to fulfill the next stages of its campaigns, which are going to have to be big if the momentum is going to be sustained. People very quickly get protest fatigue, both the protesters and the people you're trying to reach through protest. And so we need to keep ramping it up, and that means more and more people coming into it all the time. But it doesn't mean you have to be on the front line. It doesn't mean you have to be arrested.
Yeah.
All of these groups need a huge amount of backroom work as well. Loads and loads of things, everything from producing banners to organising phone trees to whatever it might be. They all need, you know, there's far more work done before an event than there is during the event itself. So please make yourself available, make yourself useful. The next thing I'd say is use the most powerful medium that has ever been invented, and that is word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever social media might bring us, whatever mainstream media might bring us, there is nothing as powerful as word of mouth, especially if that word is coming from someone you already know. So reach the people in the next circle, the people who might be sympathetic, the people who are already listening to you because you have a drink with them from time to time, whatever, but aren't quite there yet. Bring them in. Bring them into the circle. And use that incredible ability to talk and to listen that all humans possess. Very, very powerful medium that we greatly underuse. Join other campaigns as well. I mean, one I would like to highlight is the fantastic work initiated by Polly Higgins, who very sadly died just a few days ago. And her work was and is to make ecocide an international crime, absolutely crucial in the fight against planetary destruction. And the organisations that she started, if you look up Stop Ecocide, you'll find them, because I can't remember what Mission Life Force, thank you. And in fact, they've just changed the name to something else. But anyway, Mission Life Force will take you there. They are determined to make sure that her work continues. It is continuing. And the best way of honouring her remarkable life is to make sure that the mission of making ecocide a crime succeeds. Join the groups who are rewilding the land, or at least support them in one way or another. And always remember, in whatever you do, that this is fundamentally a struggle against the system rather than a struggle against any small corner of the system. It is structural and systemic change that we need to see.
Thank you. I think that was four.
No.
I think so. I'm just going to highlight some of the other things we talked about. Some obviously small, some big. You mentioned preaching to the converted, so that is actually a good thing to do. Work those low-hanging fruit, which you talked about through word of mouth. Buy British pulses. I thought that was a really nice thing that we can all do. There are lots of British pulses available on the market, and you know, much as we loathe the power of consumerism, if we increase demand for British pulses, then they will grow more British pulses. Campaigning for other things, like we spoke about a free ride in terms of air travel. George's stance is very much stop flying and enjoy a plant-based diet. Also, proportional representation is another campaign that we can get behind, and I know they've been talking about that this week in Parliament. I don't know how it went, but there was a... that was another great campaign to get behind. And you can vote green in Bristol. So I am going to move into saying our thank yous. I mean, George, it's just really fantastic that we managed to get you here in Bristol. And I really have appreciated seeing the appetite and the love that people have for you and the readiness to change. And I just want to thank you on behalf of all of us for your dedication. Like, you know, we're talking how many years now? 30, lots of years, you know, and a lot of scrapes in that time, health issues, and but your commitment to the cause and the way you use your platform for change is absolutely exemplary, and I'm so grateful for it. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.